Morning Edition commentator Sandeep Roy recently moved back to India to spend a year with his family. He'll be keeping us posted on life in the new India, a very different place from the India he left 20 years ago.
I still wake up jet-lagged in the middle of the night. There's a koel bird in a tree nearby. I've never seen it, but maybe it's jet-lagged too, because it coos incessantly from about 3 in the morning. Then the crows start to chorus, packs of dogs yap and howl, and I lie in bed worrying about my dog, Panic, my 14-year-old Chihuahua, nearly blind, going a little deaf, and half a world away in San Francisco. When I landed in Calcutta, almost the first thing my mother said was, "What did Panic do when you left?" My mother has more in common with Panic than she would care to admit. Both are having trouble with stairs. Both had surgery for cataracts around the same time, though Panic's cost more for one eye than my mother paid for both. And both are deliriously, irrationally happy whenever they see me. That's my Sophie's Choice, an aging mother in Calcutta and an elderly dog in San Francisco. When Panic showed up in my life, I was wary. I didn't want responsibility for 6.5 pounds of nervous anxiety. But soon she had wormed her way into my life, sleeping in the crook of my arm, her wet nose resting on my shoulder. "You should have just brought her with you," says my aunt. I did think about it. I called the pet relocators. They offered door-to-door service, a layover in Frankfurt at a very nice pet hotel, and a customs certificate in India. "How much would it be?" I asked, adding hopefully, "Do you charge by the pound?" "Well, about $4,000. Of course, they don't guarantee she'll make it." And I wondered, if she survived the trip, would she survive Calcutta? The mosquitoes are almost as big as she is. And would they let her back into the U.S. when I return a year later? So the dog stayed. My ex agreed to take her in. And here in India, I lie awake on jet-lagged nights, realizing I have roots in America too, deeper and more tender than I ever thought. "I'll see you soon," I whisper under my breath, just as I always tell my mother when I leave. But the only sound I hear back is the koel bird cooing in the breaking dawn.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is an editor with New America Media. He's now based in Calcutta.
Now, mention the words Black Panther, and you might think of the Black Empowerment group that was active in the late 60s and 70s. But before the political group, Black Panther was the first Black superhero in mainstream American comics. Now, more than 40 years later, the superhero is back in a new animated TV and DVD series based on the original comic. The 12-episode series is a partnership between Marvel Knights Animation and the cable network BET. It is inspired by a graphic novel written by filmmaker and former president of entertainment for BET Network's Reginald Hudlin. And Reginald Hudlin is with us now from our studios at NPR West. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you're too young to have been a devotee of the original Black Panther, I think. So how did you get interested in it?
That is not true. My older brother would bring home copies. He would not let me touch them unless I washed my hands first. But I grew up reading Fantastic Four 52, which was the debut of the Black Panther.
Okay, so you did know about it from childhood. So what made you want to do this new version of the series?
Well, the amazing thing about the Black Panther is, first of all, the Black Panther comic book in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense debuted in the same year, in 1966. So you have these brothers in Oakland and these two Jewish guys in New York who have the same brilliant idea at the same time, which is Black Panther is a very cool name.
True.
And the Black Panther superhero is a perfect idea. He's an African king who's also a superhero. He has this technologically advanced country that is completely independent. He's wealthy. He's intelligent. He's brave and strong. He's as perfect a creation as Superman or Batman or any of the great comic book characters.
Can I just ask, I think what I'm wondering is, did you always have this idea rattling around in your head that this is something you wanted to do something with at some point? Or was there a eureka moment for you that made you think, yes, now is the time?
I always wanted to write comic books. And the irony is, it's easier to break into film and television than it is to break into the comic book business. So after years of success in film and television, I got to get a meeting at Marvel, and I told them about my passion. And they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to write Black Panther. So I left that meeting with a job.
Okay, well, here it is. Let's play a clip from the first episode. This is where Black Panther encounters Captain America in his kingdom of Wakanda. This is just after the end of World War II. Let's play a short clip. Here it is.
Maybe you just lop off the head of every newcomer who hits town.
If we did that, you wouldn't have yours.
But those Nazis were here for a reason.
Yes, to steal our vibranium, the mineral that can only be found here in Wakanda. Hitler needs it for the next generation of their missile systems, as do you.
These are dangerous times. You need to choose a side.
We have our own.
So I want to mention that you've got some big name talent voicing the characters. The voice of Black Panther is that of the Academy Award nominated actor Jaimin Hunsu, originally from Benin in West Africa. You've also got Kerry Washington, Alfre Woodard, the singer Jill Scott. That must have been fun. Was it hard to get people to participate in this? Or was this one of those things where people said the same thing as you, which is, oh, no brainer, let me in?
Fortunately, it was the latter. I approached Jaimin first, and Jaimin said, yes, I've been tracking this project. So he was immediately on board and enthusiastic. Same with Kerry Washington, who's a dear friend of mine. Alfre Woodard, another dear friend of mine. My favorite story is actually from Jill Scott, who is, of course, very well known as a singer, but also as an actress. She was in an HBO series playing an African detective. And so when I approached her about playing Storm, in the animated series, she said, you know, when I was a kid, I made a list of things, of goals, and one of them was to play Storm. So I'm happy you called, but I'm not surprised.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Reginald Hudlin, the creator of a new animated series based on the comic superhero, The Black Panther. Now, the series to this point has aired on Australia TV. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Is it slated for a U.S. appearance?
It is not. It's actually, when we create the series, it's sold in a lot of territories all over the world. But right now, BET has the rights to air it in the U.S. And when we originally produced the series, in the time in between, they've changed programming direction. And they're saying that the show is too male and too young for their audience.
I am curious about who you think will be interested in it.
Well, I can tell you in the U.S. because we've released it on DVD for about a month now, and it is one of the fastest-selling DVDs in Marvel history. It's outselling similar DVDs from about X-Men and Iron Man, and those are characters who've had major feature films. But Black Panther is selling faster than in both of those.
But it is curious though that you haven't found yet a distribution platform, you know, over the air. I mean, I think some might argue that it is violent. I think it's rather violent. I don't know if you think so, but it is not more violent than a number of video games that are widely available and are shown. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about why there hasn't been a broadcast or cable distribution yet.
Well, I mean, most animated shows on television, they fall into two categories. One of them is programming for children. And as you said, this is a little sophisticated in terms of the violence, in terms of some of the political stuff. And most of the adult-oriented stuff tends to be family comedy, a la The Simpsons, Family Guy, The Cleveland Show, things like that. This is a different kind of thing. It is dramatic. It is, you know, politically provocative. And all those things, I think, are a plus, and which is why it's been a huge success to a very, very broad audience. I have to say that the reviews have been uniformly enthusiastic. The sales have been great. The first week we sold out in stores all over the country. So the question isn't is it something that people want to see? Because the numbers speak for themselves. The DVD is selling incredibly well.
Yes, you mentioned that about 3 or 4 times. Thank you,
I'm
Reginald.
Sorry.
Nicely
I'm sorry.
Done. But
no, I emphasize that only to say that one of the most frustrating things is that there's this so-called conventional wisdom about black superheroes, that black comic books don't sell and black superheroes don't sell. And a lot of the battle for black creators is overcoming these really erroneous presumptions. And, for example, look at Blade. Blade has had 3 movies, each of whom have made over $100 million. But Blade comic books don't sell. So you go, well, is there a problem with the character? Well, no. Is there a problem with the audience? No, clearly there's an audience. There's a disconnect between getting the audience that wants to see it access to this character. And that is the frustrating thing when you do something like the Black Panther, because you know there's an audience, and when the audience does get a chance to grab it, they're very enthusiastic. I talked to parents who actually, when they had I wrote the comic book as well, they would read the comic book to their kids at night, like a bedtime story. I know adults who said, look, forget my kids, I just want to watch this. And it's not a male-female thing. It's not a black, white, Latin, Asian thing. I have talked to 40-year-old white men who said, I dressed up as Black Panther when I was 7 years old for Halloween. So it's a very broad audience. Whatever you think might be the stumbling blocks aren't really there.
So we know what your costume will be for this Halloween. but before we let you go, you mentioned that when the original Black Panther came out, it came out at the same time, that the original comic, it came out at the same time that the political movement was born, and it clearly was some sort of a resonance. What is it you think people are responding to now in your series?
Well, I think, the idea of an uncompromised, unabashedly heroic black man. I mean, black men get a lot of bashing in the press. At the same time, there's so many heroes in popular media, from Sidney Poitier to Denzel Washington to Will Smith. And I think there's a tremendous hunger from all audiences for a black superhero. Not an anti-hero, but a hero, a guy who is independent, who stands on his own feet. The same way we cheer for the independence movements that's happening throughout Africa and the Middle East, because you see people standing up and fighting for what's right. The Black Panther represents those ideals played out on a big, fantastic scale.
Reginald Hudlin is one of the creators of the animated series The Black Panther. He's a filmmaker. He's also the former president of entertainment for the cable network BET. He was with us from NPR West. Reginald Hudlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you want to find out more about the Black Panther series, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Steve Inskeep is on assignment in Cairo. I'm Linda Wertheimer. In your health today, nighttime breathing problems for kids and adults. Millions of Americans don't get a good night's sleep. Sleep apnea causes them to stop breathing and wake up repeatedly throughout the night. As NPR's Patty Naiman reports, some patients can be helped by surgery.
About a year ago, Daniel Shiner knew something was wrong. He was only 32, but he was exhausted from the moment he woke up.
I had absolutely no concentration.
His job as a computer programmer suffered. So did social relationships.
I would interject something into a conversation that had already been said, or ask a question that had already been answered. When I was done with a carton of milk, I'd put it in the pantry, and I'd put trash in the fridge.
Shiner suspected sleep apnea, and it turned out he had one of the most severe cases of apnea doctors had ever seen. A sleep study revealed he woke up 112 times every hour.
If you translate that to minutes, it's about twice a minute that he stopped for a significant amount of time breathing.
Dr. Erica Thaler is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia. Shiner was put on a nighttime breathing machine. He wore a face mask in bed connected to a device that pumped air into his nose and mouth. It didn't work.
My sleep apnea was still severe, and it was very difficult to sleep because The rhythm of the machine didn't match my natural breathing patterns.
In fact, many patients who try the breathing machine can't tolerate it. It turned out that Shiner was a good candidate for surgery because his apnea was not caused by extra weight. It was caused by an obstruction. Dr. Nisha Arora, a sleep specialist at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, says this is often the cause of sleep apnea among people who are thin.
If their tonsils are big, if they've got a lot of redundant tissue in the back of the throat, a lot of soft palate tissue, all those things are something that can be taken care of surgically.
And this was Shiner's problem. His tonsils were large and he had extra tissue at the back of his throat. So he went to see surgeon Erica Thaler, who was perfecting a new technique using robotic arms to perform surgery through the mouth.
What the robot allows you to do is to get into a small confined space without your hands. So, you know, human hands are huge. And the robot's hands are tiny, and yet they can do the exact same thing if you control them remotely.
And this meant Shiner could have both his tonsils and excess tissue removed at the same time. This is such new surgery that Shiner's one of about a half a dozen patients to undergo it. Without the robot technology, Shiner's doctors would have had to make an incision in his face or neck to do the operation. Shiner says after surgery, it was a whole new life.
I'm alert. I'm energetic. I'm able to focus, get things done. I find myself solving problems much more quickly and more confidently.
This isn't the only surgery available for apnea. Everyone's anatomy is different. For some people, wires can be inserted into the palate to keep the airway open, or a screw can be anchored in the jaw to pull it forward. But these surgeries are successful only 20 to 30% of the time. Dr. Arora says only one surgery has proved effective more than 90% of the time.
People that have craniofacial abnormalities or small jaws or chins that are very far back. People with these kind of abnormalities often do well with surgery, and surgery would be preferable.
But this is structural surgery that literally repositions the bones in your face. It takes hours in the OR and months to recover, so most patients don't want to do it. Which brings us back to the non-invasive nighttime breathing machine, which has greatly improved, according to Dr. Nisha Arora.
Many of them can sense when the patient's having a respiratory event and give the pressure accordingly. There's been significant improvement over the last 10 years in these machines.
So now, around half the patients who try breathing machines get relief without surgery. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
Today, we take a closer look at the videotape that led to the ouster of two senior executives at NPR. It began last Tuesday when conservative activist James O'Keefe posted the footage. It showed the network's chief fundraiser, Ron Schiller, disparaging the Tea Party and saying that NPR would be better off without federal funding.
But that video itself is now coming under greater scrutiny. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports that much of what Schiller said was presented in a misleading light.
James O'Keefe's tapes show Ron Schiller and his deputy Betsy Lilley at an upscale cafe in Georgetown for lunch back in February. They met two men posing as officials with an Islamic trust. The men were actually O'Keefe's associates, citizen journalists, he calls them. When the conservative Daily Caller website posted an 11.5-minute version of the hidden camera video on Tuesday, it ricocheted around the blogosphere, mortified NPR, and triggered the ousters of Ron Schiller and his boss, NPR CEO Vivian Schiller, who is no relation. O'Keefe hasn't replied to several requests for comment from NPR. He told CNN's Howard Kurtz on Sunday his use of hidden cameras was in the finest traditions of muckraking journalism.
I think journalists have been doing this for a long time. I think it's a form of investigative reporting that you use to seek and find the truth.
O'Keefe told CNN his sting was inspired by NPR's decision to drop longtime news analyst Juan Williams last October for his comments on Fox News about Muslims.
The tape is very powerful. The tape is very honest. The tape cuts to the core of who these people are.
But the 26-year-old O'Keefe's own record is checkered. His takedown of the community organizing group Acorn relied on undercover videos that prosecutors in California concluded badly distorted what occurred. Last May, O'Keefe pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor after an attempted video sting at Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu's offices. In NPR's case, O'Keefe also posted a 2-hour-long video that he said was the largely raw video and audio, so people could evaluate his claims. Scott Baker is editor-in-chief of the conservative website The Blaze, created by Fox News host Glenn Beck. The site did just that.
There certainly was a lot there for conservatives and people of faith and Tea Party activists to be bothered about. But we felt like that wasn't the whole story. There were a lot of other things said that may have been complementary to conservatives and to people of faith and to Tea Party activists in the same conversations.
This weekend, I pored over the tapes aided by Baker and others with experience in analyzing video and audio tape. Broadcast journalist Al Tompkins is among them. He teaches ethics at the Poynter Institute, a journalism school in St. Petersburg, Florida. Initially, Tompkins said,
"What I saw was an executive at NPR who was expressing political, overtly political opinions that I was really uncomfortable with. Particularly the way the video was edited, it just seemed like he was spouting off about practically everything."
But Tompkins said his mind was changed by watching that 2-hour version.
"I tell my children there's two ways to lie. One is to tell me something that didn't happen, and the other is not to tell me something that did happen. I think that they employed both techniques in this."
O'Keefe's edited video triggered criticism right from his introduction, in which he ominously describes the phony Islamic group.
On the MEAC website, it said the organization sought to, quote, spread the acceptance of Sharia across the world.
"Really? That's what they said?"
That laughing response from Ron Schiller? Actually, the longer tape shows that's from an innocuous exchange as Schiller and Lily greet the two supposed donors. Again, Scott Baker.
"That to us was a signal that they were trying to condition the person watching the piece to feel as though there was assent to these ideas. That was a big warning flag."
Tompkins says O'Keefe portrayed the fundraisers as though they would do anything to appease donors. On the shorter tape, you would have heard one of the fake donors assailing a Zionist influence on the media, and Betsy Lily responding affirmingly.
"NPR is one of the few places that has the courage to really present it. There's kind of a joke that we used to call it National Palestinian Radio."
But on the shorter tape, you do not hear Ron Schiller immediately tell the two men that donors cannot expect to influence news coverage because of a firewall protecting the newsroom.
"There's such a big firewall between funding and reporting, and reporters will not be swayed in any way, shape, or form."
Reporters will not be swayed. That's from the longer tapes. Al Tompkins.
"The message that he said most often, I counted 6 times, he told these two people that he had never met before that you cannot buy coverage. He says it over and over and over again."
Sacramento-based digital forensic consultant Mark Mentz also reviewed both tapes at my request.
"The short one is definitely edited in a form and fashion to lead you to a certain conclusion. You might say it's looking at only the dirty laundry."
While Mentz said he found some of Schiller's actual remarks disturbing, he concluded the shorter video presented the conversation markedly out of sequence.
"For me, in my background, it immediately puts things into question. You really don't know what context these are in, what was going on in the 20 minutes before and after this question was asked."
Ron Schiller spoke of growing up as a Republican and admiring the party's fiscal conservatism, but said it was being taken over by people fanatical about other people's private lives. In the shorter tape, Schiller also appeared to say the GOP has been hijacked by xenophobes. In the longer tape, it's evident Schiller is not offering his own views, but quoting two influential Republicans, if uncritically. The videos gave fresh momentum to congressional Republicans seeking to cut all federal funding for public broadcasting. Schiller appears to be telling the two donors NPR would do just fine without federal dollars, though some stations would go dark. On the longer tape, it's clear Schiller says that would be disastrous for public radio in the short term. Al Tompkins says O'Keefe's editing was blatantly unfair.
"Except for a couple of unfortunate forays into political opinion, I think that Ron Schiller actually did a fairly remarkably good job of explaining how NPR works and what you can and cannot expect if you contribute money to the NPR Foundation."
The Blaze's Scott Baker.
"I think if you look at the 2 hours in total, you largely get an impression that these are pretty, they seem to be fairly balanced people trying to do a fairly good job."
Late last night, NPR Senior Vice President Dana Davis-Rem issued a statement saying O'Keefe inappropriately edited the videos with an intent to discredit the network. But NPR, she said, had confirmed from the outset that Ron Schiller had indeed made egregious statements. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The field for the NCAA men's basketball tournament is set. Four powerhouse programs have the number one seeds, Duke, Ohio State, Kansas, and Pittsburgh. The tournament has expanded to 68 teams this year. The bracket waiting in your inbox will look a little different. NPR's Mike Pesca is here with us to talk about it. Mike, you're going to be living this tournament for the next 3 weeks. Tell us how the expanded structure will work.
Well, there is often, or in a few years past, there has been a play-in game. And how this usually worked is the worst teams vie for the spot to get obliterated by a number one seed. But they've expanded this play-in format to not only include teams that are trying to be the 16th seed, but teams that could be maybe the 12th or 11th seed. So with 68 teams, more teams who were supposedly on the bubble are now being invited to play in the tournament. And this was supposed to take care of a lot of the controversy about teams that have been left off. Guess what? It didn't really do it. There's still the controversy, but there'll be a few more games leading up to Thursday.
So we mentioned the top seeds, Duke, Ohio State, Kansas, Pittsburgh. Is there a clear favorite?
Right now, it looks like people are favoring either Duke or Ohio State. Compared to past years, there's not one clear favorite. Last year, Kansas was the odds-on favorite, but they didn't go very far in the tournament. So I don't know how much stock to put in that. I would say of the number one seeds, they're a bit less powerful this year than they have been in some years past. 3 or 4 weeks ago, the top four ranked teams in the country all lost. So there was a situation where the fifth team, which was Duke at the time, sort of inherited the number one spot. So there hasn't been any team or any one or two teams vying for supremacy all year, and we see that reflected in the brackets.
So how does the rest of the field look this year?
Well, like I said, the bubble team, Virginia Tech, has a pretty good argument that they were left out. They beat the number one seed, Duke. But no matter how many teams you let in the tournament, there's always going to be the last team that was left out. And sometimes they're going to have a legitimate complaint, and sometimes they're not. I think the biggest complaint is not necessarily of a team that was left out, but the seeding. There's a team, Utah State, that in the last ranking in the AP poll was something like 17th. This is a very good team, but they don't get to play quality opponents. They had only three losses on the season. And they got a 12th seed, which tells you that the people who make up the seedings think they're about the 40th best team in the country, whereas no college basketball expert ranks them anywhere near that low. But the good thing about Utah State is all they have to do is win a game. It's against the 5th seeded Kansas State team. But once they do, they sort of become the 5th seed. Maybe their second round game will get a little bit easier if they could survive that first round contest.
Well, what about some little outfit like Butler University in Indiana, which very nearly won last year? Any upset possibilities in view?
Well, sure. And to look at the Butler game, they're playing a very good team, Old Dominion, who a lot of people, I think me among them, think that they could beat Butler and then even beat Pittsburgh, which is the number one seed in their region. There are other teams that have their profiles, a team like Belmont, which only played three good teams this year, but they came very close to winning all of them, and they're a 13th ranked seed. And then a 2 seed, San Diego State, so they're telling you that's a good team, but San Diego State's off a lot of people's radars. They could make a run and do a lot of damage in the tournament.
Okay, Mike, stay in touch.
Yes, of course.
NPR's Mike Pesca talking about the NCAA.